This is an ABC podcast.
G'day there and welcome to Between the Lines, on air, online or via your ABC Listen app. This is Tom Switzer and thanks for tuning in. On the program, Australia's rapidly developing relationship with India.
Mr. Modi's contribution here is very important, very significant. He has in a way galvanized Indian bureaucracy and made it very clear to his Australian counterparts that India is willing to invest in this relationship. And so the reciprocity from Canberra has also been quite expansive.
Stay with us for Indian scholar Harsh Pant on finding kinship in the pushback against China. But first, Rory Medcalf, one of our nation's leading strategic thinkers. Professor Rory Medcalf has been a widely acclaimed proponent of the quadrilateral security dialogue. That's in the context of the emerging Indo-Pacific region. Now, the Quad was reinstituted in 2017, and it now helps define the regional strategic thinking as China's reach and influence extends. A former diplomat and analyst in Australia's peak intelligence agency, Rory is head of the National Security College at Canberra's Australian National University. His new book is called Indo-Pacific Empire, China, America, and the Contest for the World's Pivotal Region. That's published by Manchester for an international audience. It's a revised version of his 2020 book, Contest for the Indo-Pacific, Why China Won't Map the Future. And it's been widely praised by the FT's Gideon Ruckman and Professor Lawrence Friedman from the King's College London. Rory, welcome to Between the Lines.
It's great to be here, Tom.
Now, first, the controversy over submarines. Now, this has dominated ABC news coverage during the past week or so. What do you make of the French criticism of Australia?
Well, I think France has understandable reason to be concerned and aggrieved and disappointed that its major contract to provide and build diesel electric submarines for Australia has been, cancelled at a contractual gateway, as the government calls it. And France has reason to be disappointed at the damage that does to the way it saw its Indo-Pacific strategy of broad regional engagement. However, if France is a serious strategic player in this region, then it is going to be such a player regardless of whether it has this major arms deal with Australia or some other country. And so I think the test for France actually is now. And it is concerning to see the degree to which the French president, in the context of French domestic politics, has been really helping to amplify or magnify this issue and to really cast doubts on Australia's own Indo-Pacific strategy at a time when we should be pulling together. This family feud in the Indo-Pacific isn't helpful, regardless of what we think.
Let me put this quote to you. This is Paul Keating, the former Australian Prime Minister in the early to mid-1990s. He says, the submarine decision, quote, rudely affronts Europe's sole international power, France, the one European state which possesses a sophisticated military, nuclear submarines and nuclear weapons, and along with that, real Pacific national assets. Keating goes on to say France is, quote, a genuine Pacific power. One could have hardly dreamt up a more adequate or a more appropriate military partner than France. Now, that's Paul Keating. That's his critique of AUKUS. Rory Medcalf, is France a genuine Pacific power?
Well, a couple of things, Tom. Firstly, at one level, it's actually kind of refreshing to hear Paul Keating endorse the building of coalitions in the Indo-Pacific with a wide range of partners. And I think the subtext there is the need to balance Chinese power. So I'd like to think that that Mr. Keating gets that point and applauds that point. Secondly, although France is important, ultimately, and we may come to this later if we can, ultimately AUKUS is about the deepest level of technology partnership with the United States and Britain, and the calculation has been made that what they have on offer is going to do more for Australia's strategic weight and, moreover, is embedded in the US alliance system in the Indo-Pacific. And there is something unique there that Australia needs and I believe can rely on, because when it comes to confrontation or potentially conflict in the Indo-Pacific, we know, we're confident, I think, where America's objectives will lie. There will be some uncertainty about where France and some European players fall in those circumstances. Is France a genuine, quote, Pacific or Indo-Pacific power? Well, France has territory in the region. It has stakes and interests in the region, island territories in the Pacific Ocean and the Indian Ocean. It had those stakes in the region before the submarine deal with France was on the horizon, before the French bid actually, if you like, stole the show from the Japanese in 2016. And France will continue to be, I believe, an Indo-Pacific player, even if, for example, the referendum in New Caledonia this December doesn't necessarily go France's way. But it's not the only power that we can count on.
Okay. Well, talking about the major powers, you mentioned the US and Britain. What about the optics of AUKUS? Here's Yun Jiang. She's director of ANU's China Policy Centre on the ABC's PM.
With this agreement and under the current government generally, we're looking more to the West and our Anglosphere partners much more. It's almost like we're back to seeking security from Asia rather than security in Asia. We're not putting as much effort into broadening and now deepening our relationship with other countries in the Asian region.
Yun Jiang on the ABC's PM, Rory Medcalf.
Look, it's a reasonable observation to make at surface level when you see the optics of AUKUS. You know, the fact that you had America, Britain and Australia leaders lining up to make this announcement. You had the red, white and blue of the three flags on display and so forth. You know, I can understand that perception, but there are some very important points of context here. One, of course, is that the so-called Anglosphere of these three countries, or the Five Eyes countries, if you want to extend it, is in fact not about some kind of Anglo culture. These are some of the most multicultural liberal democracies in the world. So it is much more fundamentally, I think, about shared principles and about a willingness to support one another with capabilities. Secondly, it's not as if Australia has been a laggard on engagement with the region. I mean, the Quad, India and Japan, the two most powerful Asian states other than China, are not only now much more deeply embedded partners of Australia, but moreover, those countries and a number of other Asian Indo-Pacific partners are actually quite comfortable with Australia acquiring more strategic weight under AUKUS. And I'd note in particular, Japan, the Philippines and Singapore were very open in their comfort levels with AUKUS. And I understand that India and Vietnam privately are pretty okay with it, while, of course, Indonesia and Malaysia are countries where we need to do more diplomatic spade work.
You're on RN with me, Tom Switzer, and my guest is Professor Rory Medcalf. He's one of our nation's leading strategic thinkers, whose new book is called Indo-Pacific Empire, China, America, and the Contest for the World's Pivotal Region. Rory, you mentioned the Quad. This is the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue. So it's India, Australia, the US, and Japan. You've been part and parcel of these intellectual debates surrounding the Quad for many years. Thought experiment, would it have existed without China's conduct in recent times?
Look, short answer, no, at least not in its present form. Fair to say that the original Quad was the core group of responders to the terrible tsunami that hit this region, that hit the Indo-Pacific on Boxing Day 2004. So back then, it was about providing public goods. It was about four countries that mobilised quickly, that had the capabilities, the trust, the willingness to act. But since then, as the Quad has evolved, and remember, it did go into hibernation, to put it politely, between 2008 and 2017, as it's evolved, of course, it's been in significant part about balancing Chinese power And if it hadn't been for China's confrontational, assertive, and at times coercive behaviour towards each of those four countries, I don't think we would have seen the political comfort levels that have got us to now Quad summits, to the Quad having a very broad agenda, vaccines, technology.
Okay, but is the Quad really capable of checking Beijing's regional ambitions? Among other critics, once again, Paul Keating, he's sceptical of India's commitment if the strategic competition becomes more intense. This is Keating, quote, "The moment a loud shot was fired, the Indians would lock themselves in their peninsula, leaving the United States and mugs like us, Australia, carrying a military fight to the Chinese all by our righteous selves." Now, does Paul Keating have a point here? After all, unlike Japan and Australia, Rory, India is not a strategic treaty ally of the Americans. It is a developing economy, and it might not be able to absorb an international economic hit from Chinese embargo. So the question here is, can India be taken seriously as a counterweight to China? Rory Medcalf.
Tom, how long have you got for the answer to that one? So, look, first piece of context, like a lot of Australians, I respect what Paul Keating in his day did for Australia's activist diplomacy in our region. But in fact, the Quad is a manifestation of that same spirit of activist diplomacy, creative middle player diplomacy by Australia engaging with the region. That's the first point. The second point is that the Quad and the Indo-Pacific, this is about building a whole range of coalitions. It's not just about India. And in some ways, I would contend that the Quad can be a core group for balancing arrangements. But when it comes to that military dimension of balancing China, you know, look at a Taiwan contingency, for example, I don't think anyone's pretending that suddenly we will see the Indian Navy steaming to the rescue. It's going to work in a more sophisticated way than that. But finally, on India itself, India has its own very mistrustful and confrontational relations with China. And it is somewhat, if you like, offensive, at least if I was looking at this from an Indian perspective, I'd find it a bit bemusing to have that suggestion that somehow India has this strategic timidity. I mean, the fact is that India has faced China, deterred China, stared China down, and will continue to do so, I believe. That doesn't mean that India's as strong a power as China. It's significantly weaker, but it has the ability and the willingness to resist. And that itself has a pretty important power of example to others. I think the cooperation that we have with India under the Quad or bilaterally or in other arrangements has a long way to play out. And a lot of it will be about building one another's capacity, for example, in technology or supporting third nations in the region, rather than the kind of crude NATO-like alliance that I think critics like Mr. Keating imagine. And ironically, the same critics will say the Quad is bad because it is, quote, reckless on an international scale, which was a comment that Mr. Keating made a few years ago, accusing the Quad of being a containment strategy against China. And yet the same critics will say the Quad's no good because it's weak.
Okay, but now this is all obviously in the context of China's rapid military modernisation. You, like many Australians, are anxious about this, but let me push back and conclude on this note. Isn't just China modestly flexing its muscles as its power increases, its definition of its national interests grows, its strategic priorities are still confined to Northeast Asia? Now, to the extent that's true, why should we be so worried about it? Rory.
So firstly, I don't think that's true. And I think the point of my book, I mean, you've mentioned, the new edition of my book with the maybe slightly provocative title of Indo-Pacific Empire. And I will give away the punchline. The empire I allude to is the quasi-imperial ambitions that I think we're seeing from China across the Indo-Pacific. You know, the Belt and Road is Xi Jinping's signature initiative. It includes what's called the Maritime Silk Road, a major strategic initiative since at least 2013. That is about China building connectivity, influence, and presence across the Indo-Pacific because China sees its dependence on the sea lanes for resources and energy and trade as being absolutely vital to the Communist Party's ability to maintain control domestically. So I would contend with the view that somehow China has this narrow sphere of interest that will be confined to East Asia. And I think in many ways, China has this accelerating map of vulnerability across the Indo-Pacific, which provides the opportunity for other countries to balance against Chinese power across this much larger canvas, while at the same time recognizing the need to deter the more, dire and adventurous actions that China could take in East Asia, particularly against Taiwan. It's going to be tough, but it is, whether we like it or not, an Indo-Pacific game, not a narrow East Asian contest.
Rory, great to have you back on RN.
Pleasure to be on the program, Tom. Thank you very much.
Rory Medcalf is head of the ANU's National Security College, and the revised international version of his 2020 book is called Indo-Pacific Empire: China, America, and the Contest for the World's Pivotal Region, and we'll put a link to that book on our homepage.
This is Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
Well, in today's increasingly volatile Indo-Pacific region, Australia's relationship with India has never been so important, nor have ties between our two nations ever been so close. After all, we share a similar assessment of the region. Our strategic partners are the same. We have common political values, and our economic partnership is growing. So observes Harsh Pant in the current edition of Australian Foreign Affairs that's just out by Black Ink Books. The article is called The View from India, and the author, Harsh Pant, is Professor of International Relations at King's College London. Hello, Harsh. Welcome to ABC Radio.
Hello, Tom. Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Now, this level of comfort that I just mentioned between Australia and India, it is extraordinary given how distant these two nations seemed just a decade ago. Take us back to 2009-2010 during the attacks on Indian students.
Oh, yes. I think this has been one of the most extraordinary stories of how the larger structure and realities changing international environment really transforms bilateral relations, because clearly, when you talk of similar political values, when you talk of similar societies, when you talk of similar aspirations in the two societies, that has been quite evident for a long time. But the relationship, for various reasons, was largely consumed by these three C's, as is often portrayed. You know, you had the Commonwealth, cricket, and curry syndrome, beyond which the relationship could not progress. So I think what has happened, and if you go back to this time period that you are mentioning, when actually there were the seeming attacks on Indian students in Australia, it generated a lot of backlash in India. That Indian middle classes had started. That was the time when Indian middle classes, a decade or so back, were sending out students abroad for studies, and a lot of them, instead of going to traditional, Western nations like the UK or the USA, also started looking at Australia as an important country to go to study, given Australia's excellent educational establishments. And that was something that happened for a very brief period. There were some of these attacks that happened, and that vitiated the climate for a while. And because the ignorance about the two societies in each in each of the two countries was quite significant at that point in time, these events were blown out of proportion to what was actually happening on the ground, and the media generated a hype around these attacks that seemed as if Australia is not welcoming to the Indian students, and that there was an element of racism involved, and an Indian government had to intervene, and the two governments had to talk to each other about what was happening. And for a while it seemed as if this issue or this perception is going to change the way at least many middle classes in India looked at Australia as a potential destination for education and business. But I think what happened since then in the last decade has been quite transformative, because at all levels we have seen a significant change in public perception. Where for many in India, Australia was this distant country which was good for tourism, good for education, but nothing beyond that. And for many Australians, it seemed as if India is again, yes, it's a democracy, yes, it's a multicultural, multi-ethnic entity which is trying to get out of low rates of economic growth. But beyond that, there's no attraction beyond cricket and culinary aspects. So I think what has happened in the last decade is actually quite transformative and very, very interesting in the way in which the two nations are now looking at not simply their bilateral relations, but also what is happening in the region and how the regional environment can be used to not only give a boost to their bilateral relationship, but also to structure regional architecture which can embed this relationship. And I think, we can talk about Quad, et cetera, but I think that is what has happened in the last decade, where from the leadership level, there has been a lot of investment, and from the bottom up, from the civil society aspect, there has been a lot of engagement at multiple levels, whether it's economic, whether it's social, cultural, as well as, of course, political.
Yes, and that's, of course, not to mention China, which has done more than anything to unite not just Australia and India, but also the United States and Japan, the so-called Quad. But is the Quad really capable of checking Beijing's regional ambitions?
Since you were talking about the essay and we are talking in the context of this conversation, I think it is important how China frames a lot of our conversations today, whether it is on trade, technology, infrastructure, vaccines today in the context of COVID-19. China is at the core of many of these conversations, how to manage this transformative rise of China. So when you look at Australia-India relationship and you look at the Quad, the idea, it seems to me, is not to make it a NATO-like alliance structure against China, but I think to give the region some alternatives to what China is offering. Because China, it seems, is offering a lot. China has a lot of resources. China has lots of capabilities. Sometimes it is for the benefit of the regional environment. But a lot of the time, it seems China's aggressive policies that create discomfort for other nations. That means that those nations that are like-minded will have to come together and offer alternatives, whether it is on trade, technology, whether it is on infrastructure and connectivity, whether it is on the idea that democracies can work. Democracies can deliver, because what China is telling the world today is that Chinese model, which is an authoritarian model, is more efficient, that it is delivering better, it is delivering faster, it is a model that other nations should emulate, and therefore China should be the leader of this region and of the world. And I think the idea for four like-minded nations like Australia, India, Japan, and the US to come together in the Indo-Pacific and to articulate an alternative to the Chinese model is something that is very, very important. To that extent, there is a lot of potential there. There are a lot of very good ideas on the table. We have seen a lot of investment. Tom, this is a very interesting story. In 2007, when Quad was first initiated, when the idea of Quad was first brought to the table, Australians and Indians were probably the ones who rejected it. The idea was that let's not go down this road because it might make China more aggressive. But what happened from 2007 to 2017 was China actually became more aggressive without India and Australia joining the Quad. So I think the lessons that perhaps Canberra and New Delhi learned was that China's rise and China's actions are dictated more by Chinese ambitions themselves than by anything that other nations were doing. And in 2021, of course, it has been a dramatic year for Quad when we have seen the Biden administration, the new administration in Washington, calling leaders level summits twice in a matter of in less than 6 months. In March, they had the virtual summit, and just in September, they had the first in-person summit of the Quad leaders in Washington.
Professor Harsh Pant is with King's India Institute and the King's College London. He's also with the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi. He's the author of The View from India, in the current edition of Australian Foreign Affairs. It's published by Black Ink Books. Obviously, the strategic competition with China is intensifying. We had the India-China border crisis last year that culminated in the deaths of Indian troops. We've had China's economic coercion against Australia in the course of the COVID crisis. Obviously, Chinese assertiveness, as you say in your Australian Foreign Affairs essay, that's intensified the cooperation between Canberra and Delhi. Do you think this closer relationship between India and Australia will survive the Modi BJP era? That is, does the left of centre Congress party in India, do they hold the same views about Australia and the US re their anxieties about China? Harsh pant.
Tom, I think that there is no doubt that Mr. Modi has certainly given a lot of dynamism to Indian foreign policy. And I think in particular, what has happened with Australia and his visit to Australia.
And by the way, that was the first trip by an Indian prime minister since 1986, correct?
Absolutely. And I think that is why that visit was important. That is why how he underscored the relationship and how we framed the relationship, not simply a relationship between two democracies or two nations, but also a relationship that is important for the wider region. So I think Mr. Modi's contribution here is very important, very significant. He has in a way galvanized Indian bureaucracy, also pushed and made it very clear to his Australian counterparts that India is willing to invest in this relationship. And so the reciprocity from Canberra has also been quite expansive. What has also happened in India, last year's border crisis, India and China share a long border. It has been a long, a contested border. But there were protocols in place to ensure that there is peace and tranquility along the border. What happened last year, it meant that China was willing to unilaterally alter the status quo along the border, which is India's position now, that unless China goes back to those positions along the border, which existed prior to March 2020, that border issue will now be at the heart of this relationship, which means that basically reducing dependence on China, Japan, Australia, and India to a large degree are over-reliant on China for critical imports, for critical technologies. And I think that is something that the mood in India has shifted dramatically against China. And you get a similar sense in Australia as well. You know, this is not simply a relationship today that is being driven top down. There is a large reservoir of, I think, a love and an affection for Australia, you know, at least in the urban youth. And if that youth is going to govern the country or is being in key positions of power over the next few decades, then I think you can imagine the push and pull factors here working in favor of Australia-India relationship.
And we should stress that, as you highlight in your essay, sadly, for most Australians, despite everything you've said, India figures lightly in the political and economic imagination, if at all. Harsh, we're out of time. Thanks so much for being on RN.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. Pleasure.
Harsh Pant, he's Professor of International Relations at King's College London, and he's the author of The View from India. It's in the current edition of Australian Foreign Affairs, as published by Black Ink Books. Well, that's it for the week, and remember to hear this or past episodes, including last month's program with the award-winning journalist Shari Markson on what really happened in Wuhan. If you'd like to hear that show or others, just go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to Between the Lines. Or, of course, you can just go to ABC's Listen app, where you can download us for free or wherever you get your shows online. I'm Tom Switzer, and thanks as always for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.